Hi there, my name is Ulrich Christensen of IncaJourneys.com, and this is the story of the last Inca princess. You can download the podcast and play it whenever you want, or you can listen to it here on the website. There will be more podcasts and more blog posts and lots more material about the Inca Empire and the last Inca princess, but this is where it all starts. This is the story. The name of the last Inca princess was, well, difficult to pronounce. Coyacaspiquipi Manco Capac. So I've opted just to call her Coya throughout this part. You can live with that. She was born in 1521 in a place called Surampali, which is in present-day Ecuador, near the city of Cuenca. Now, this was a major capital of the Incas for this region after they had conquered it. And her father, Emperor Huayna Capac, often resided there. Now, during her childhood, at some point in the 1520s, she was actually given to a guardian. It was custom amongst the Incas, as it was among European families in medieval times, that their children at some point should go live with another family with whom they wanted to forge closer bonds. So Coya was given to a guardian. It was her father's warrior chief, the cacique, that's in for chief, by the name of Cariapasa. Now, Cariapasa was lord of the Lupaca nation, which is a tribe nation settled near the Lake Titicaca, the holy lake of the Incas. This nation had been incorporated into the Inca Empire, that's another word for conquered, at the time of her great-grandfather, Emperor Pachacu. We don't know very much about that, except what I've just told you, but rest assured, Coya spent some years of her childhood getting up and looking out over the Lake Titicaca, the holy lake of the Incas. And if you've ever been there, or you're going there, you know what I mean when I say that there's a reason that this place feels holy. It's a really, really magical place. And Coya's life, seemingly, is going to be magic. I mean, she is born as an Inca princess into the top part of the Inca hierarchy, and she can look forward to a life in splendor. But when she's still a young girl in 1527, something happens that erases the magic quite brutally. Her father dies. Emperor Huayna Capac dies, presumably of smallpox, which had come down from the early Spanish settlements in the Caribbean. The indigenous peoples, including the Incas, had no resistance against these new foreign diseases, and the Inca emperor would not be the last to succumb to such diseases. Now what happens then is that Coya's brother, Huascar, he becomes emperor. At least for a little while, because in the next 5 years, there is a civil war between Huascar and Coya's half-brother, Atahualpa. Now, the Inca emperor, he had many wives, and then there was one wife, which was sort of the most important one, the queen, the number one wife, and that was Coya's mother, and then there were all the rest. And one of her many half-brothers, Atahualpa, he wanted to be emperor instead of Huascar. So the civil war erupted and went on for some years, which gradually must have darkened the sense of security and optimism and carefreeness, which I suppose was very much in Coya's life until now. There's a war going on, and she could be assured that if her half-brother won, her fate would be very uncertain. And that is what happens. In 1532, when she's about 11 years old, or maybe 12, Huascar is caught after losing a decisive battle against Atahualpa. He's later killed by order of Atahualpa along with much of his family. Now, Coya and her only surviving sister, Marca, are spared. We don't know what happened to their mother and some of the other family members we'll get back to, but Coya and her sister, they are spared after Atahualpa wins due to their youth and their virginity. And we'll get back to that shortly. They are kept prisoners in Cusco, the Inca capital, to await Atahualpa's triumphant return and to become part of his personal harem. And that's what I meant when I said we'll get back to it, because obviously and unfortunately, and that was how the times were, and especially in this quite brutal culture, which was the culture of the Incas, if you were on the losing side, you could either be killed or enslaved, like Coya and Marca they are going to be. Also, as an example, you know, to the rest of Atahualpa's enemies, this is what's going to happen. an example. This is a humiliation of the family of Waskar, the losing family. So it's supposed to send a very strong signal as well, I believe, to the remainders of the loyalists of Waskar's. There was also another aspect in this quite brutal fate for the two girls. The Incan nobles, they normally married brothers and sisters. Yes, they did. In order to maintain the bloodline as pure as possible. So that part of it wasn't culturally as offensive as we would probably see today. But the two teenage girls likely weren't too thrilled that they could sit there as prisoners and a lot of their family was dead and now they could just await this fate. Yeah, more than likely they were very, very frightened about what was going to happen to them in the near future. And unfortunately, things were going to get a whole lot worse. By November 1532, Atahualpa is still out there campaigning. He's mopping up the remnants of Huascar loyalists. So he hasn't come home to stay in Cusco just yet and claim his prize, including the poor girls. And now he never will, because Atahualpa and his royal bodyguard, they are caught in an ambush and imprisoned by a seemingly insignificant but quite lethal group of Spanish conquistadors called conquerors in English. Now, they had arrived in northern Peru only a short time before in search of gold and fortune. And their leader, Francisco Pizarro, a poor boy from the Extremadura in Spain, gone to the New World, as many of those, in search of fame and fortune. He's a badass. He's basically a mercenary, and he knows the craft of war. And he decides in the summer of 1533 to execute Atahualpa in the city of Cajamarca, where he was caught. But he waits until after he has collected a room full of gold for Atahualpa's ransom. It's pretty clever and pretty brutal. Now, later in 1533, Pizarro's men, the first Spanish soldiers, arrive in Cusco. On their way, they have met another half-brother of Coyas, Manco Inca, 17-year-old boy, and he actually sided with Huascar. So he's on the run from Atahualpa's men, and then he meets Pizarro's men, and he agrees now to become the new Inca emperor. Manco probably believes that he can control the Spaniards. He probably underestimates them, just like Atahualpa did, but he's quite wrong. They control him, and he is, for all intents and purposes, a puppet. And Pizarro obviously hopes that this kind of fake construction around a new Inca emperor appointed by him, that it will help him in the long run, both in the short and the long run. He still feels that he needs an official Inca figurehead. I mean, the Spanish position in Peru here is not particularly strong. They are a couple of hundred soldiers and there are thousands of Incas out there. So he needs to help some of the factions which were loyal to, for example, Huascar, and who hope that his family can be reinstated as emperors, or at least someone loyal to them. So he's pretty much playing divide and conquer now. He hopes that an official Inca figurehead can make more Inca auxiliaries, other tribes people, rally around him and his faction. He has now become a faction in the civil war with Manco as his figurehead. So if Pizarro can keep playing the Inca factions against each other, or the factions that were involved in the civil war, or the factions, the tribes who want to get rid of the Incas and who want more independence, then he can gradually grind the empire down, finally take over himself. Of course, he's not telling anyone this, but that's pretty much what his plan is. And he's already well on the way. And as I said before, with only a few hundred men, but these men have guns and steel armor and steel swords and horses, and they are trained in professional warfare as mercenaries in various European wars before they came to seek the new fortune here in the New World. So they are quite lethal compared to the Bronze Age technology Inca warriors who have clubs and slings for their primary weapon. Now, jump ahead about a year or a year and a half. Coya is first with her half-brother, Manco Inca, as he returns to Cusco, newly crowned as puppet emperor. But very soon, she is given to a Spanish soldier, a lieutenant of Pizarro's, a very able young man called Mancio Leguizamo. He's a 22-year-old lieutenant of Pizarro's, and she's given to him as his concubine. In other words, as his sex slave. I guess we would call it that today. And she's only about 14 at this time. Her sister Marca is given to another conquistador, Diego Almagro, who is Pizarro's powerful second in command. And of course, there's also some signaling here that we give these Inca princesses as prizes of war to the up and coming conquerors, just like Atahualpa wanted them for himself after he defeated Huascar. So it's more of the same for the poor girls there. You know, they're just thrown around between these men who wage war on each other with all kinds of brutality. And for them, it's probably just a question right now of trying to survive and not make too much of a fuss and, bide their time. Now, why does Manco agree that a part of his family, maybe his half-sisters, yes, but a part of his family, that they should hand it out to the Spanish conquerors? Well, he may not have liked it, but whatever way you look at it, either he was forced to agree to this in order to stay in power, or maybe he just willingly supported it because he figured that, what the hell, they were only women, they're bargaining chips in a way. So we are at this juncture here where it's a jungle out there, and the Inca Empire is fracturing rapidly, and everybody is fighting for survival. Now, a year more passes, and we are in 1536, and Manco, he's beginning to see the light. He's so ill-treated by the Spaniards that he decides to escape and rebel. Coya has heard about his plans before he leaves Cusco, and she's 15-year-old, and she now has a choice to make. She could try to lay low and hope that Manco will defeat the Spaniards and somehow help her get her back into the royal family and into the position she was in before, normalize her life, so to speak, if that is even possible for her to imagine at this juncture. Or she could tell the Spaniards that she knows about these plans and they better prepare for it and hope that they will win and that they will ultimately help her survive. And she chooses the latter. She chooses to tell Mancho, her master, who in turn tells Hernando Pizarro, Francisco Pizarro's brother, who's the leader of the Spaniards who remained in Cusco, tells him to get ready. Because there's only a relatively small Spanish garrison now in Cusco, along with a couple of thousand native auxiliaries, while the rest of the already still very small group of conquistadors there spread out over the empire trying to claim new lands. Only about, I think, 150 Spaniards in Cusco remain. Now, this probably wasn't an easy choice for a teenage girl, or young woman, you might call her. She has been forced to grow up pretty rapidly, even if her brother Manco arguably threw her to the wolves the year before that. But like I said before, it's all about survival now. Coya is gambling that the Spaniards will win and that they can best protect her. Now, Manco, he scrambles together a very large army and lays siege to Cusco for many months. But ultimately, he's unsuccessful. He can't take the city and he has to retreat into the jungle to Vilcabamba, a place on the edge of the vast Amazon where he has to hide. Part of the reason why he does that is that he can't really take Cusco in time before Spanish reinforcements arrive, including some led by Diego Almagro, Pizarro's right-hand man, who's been back over in Chile trying to conquer that part of the Inca Empire. They were very ambitious, these Spaniards. He comes back, presumably with Coya's sister Marca, who's then reunited with Coya, which must have been bittersweet, as they are now firmly in the Spanish camp, and they are, slaves, concubines, if you want, to these men who are rapidly gaining power all over the empire. Now, there might have been another reason why Coya also decided to help the Spaniards. She gives birth in the summer of 1537 to her first son. She's only 16 years old, and the father is Mancho, the Spanish conquistador. Now, the chronology is a bit fussy, but assuming that she might have been pregnant around the time when he betrayed her brother, she might also have figured that he probably wouldn't let a bastard child like that live. I don't know, I'm just speculating. But certainly something that she would have thought about. But she gives birth, very young indeed, to a little boy who's called Juan. And now, while the Spanish rule is becoming more and more secure, what's more natural for the Spaniards than to fight over the spoils? So that's what they do. Diego Almagro, Pizarro's right-hand man, decides he would like to rule Cusco. Well, all of Peru, in fact. So he starts off by imprisoning Pizarro's brothers, Gonzalo and Hernando, who are in Cusco, and their allies, which include Coya's master, or husband, if you will. I mean, they're not married, Mancho. So Mancho is thrown into prison, and presumably Almagro takes Coya and gives her to another of his captains. We don't know what happened to her at this time, but this seems the most likely turn of events. So in 1539, with the Incas all but defeated and the Spanish are still fighting amongst the spoils, what happens is that Almagro loses that war and he's executed. Marca, Coya's sister, gets married off to another conquistador called Villacastín, and Mancho, her previous master, the father of her son, who has been in prison for over a year, he comes out of prison now, and he refuses to take her back. Well, likely, as I said, because she's been in the hands of someone else. That's likely the reason why he didn't want her back. So now, when the 1530s are closing, we have this 17-year-old girl or young woman with a baby son who's forced to fend for herself in the conquered and transformed Inca capital, which is now Spanish. So there she is in what must have been deep poverty and despair, roaming the streets, presumably prostituting herself to survive. A Spanish friar called Valverde, he takes pity on Coya and other Inca noble women who now walk the streets, and he writes to the Spanish king to get him to provide for the Inca princesses like Coya, who are often, yeah, like I said, likely forced into prostitution and or begging to survive. And the king actually agrees to that, to give Coya and others like her a little bit of land, which was taken from them originally, but never mind that. And that's pretty much at this time when a minor treasury official of the Spaniards, Pedro Bustinza, he discovers Coya. Now she has a bit of land, so great, there's someone I want to marry. Bustinza, now, first I need to say, in case you missed it before, Coya was never really married to Mancho. She was just his slave or mistress or concubine. But with Bustinza, she gets an official real marriage, although it's likely one of convenience, very likely. As Bustinza would like to marry an Inca princess who has a bit of land, because he's a mid-rank Spanish nobleman. He has a title of some sort, but he doesn't have the land. Back in Spain, he's an impoverished nobleman, so he went to the New World, like so many others, to get some money and some land which befitted his position, his title. And he sees, likely, Coya as a way to get that. So Coya is now baptized, and she's given her full Christian name, Beatriz Huayas Nusta. So now she's Beatriz. And what is she actually granted? Well, the land she's granted, and which Bustinza also gets control over for marrying her, but in turn offering her some level of security and for her children as well. That land is an encomienda, as it is called, named Urcos, which is southeast of Cusco. And it is actually in the ancestral lands of her mother. There's a bit of a connection there, a silver lining to all of this. Beatriz has two sons with Bustinza, Pedro and Martin. And then, of course, Juan, their half-brother, he lives with them. And things kind of settle down for a while. Presumably, she tries to get some kind of normalcy into her life as best she can. And she really needs it, because she's also in charge of two of Manco's daughters. A little princess called Usesino and another little princess called Ancasica. Manco left these two girls in Cusco 8 years previously. We're now in the early 1540s. Presumably, they were with the Spaniards or some other family until Beatriz had the opportunity to make them part of her household. So don't tell me that she doesn't have some grit, this young woman, taking care of all of these children under these very, very difficult circumstances. And speaking of Manco, he gets the axe, almost literally. It's 1544, and some Spaniards are on the run from one of the many altercations between the Spanish factions, one of the many rebellions or civil wars, if you will, amongst the Spaniards. There are some Spaniards on the run from other Spaniards, and they decide they want to seek refuge in Vilcabamba. So they go out to Manco, and you know, he gives them, he allows them to stay, and they murder him. Then they go, I think they are planning then to go back to the other Spaniards and say, hey, we murdered Manco. Maybe, you know, you can forget that we were part of a rebellion or something like that. But they are, if I recall correctly, they are murdered by the Incas before they get very far. And Manco's son, Sayri Túpac, he now takes over the leadership of this small remnant of Incas who are still totally free, but who live in this very small part of the former empire in these valleys on the edge of the Amazon jungle near Vilcabamba. Flash forward to 1547, Pedro Bustinza, Coy's husband, or Beatriz's husband, he's made mayor of Cusco by Gonzalo Pizarro, and that likely prompts him to support Gonzalo's rebellion. And, you know, there's another Spanish rebellion, this time it's against the viceroy. Pizarro, he's long gone. He was assassinated in 1541, but his brothers are still very much alive, and they don't like that the Spanish king has sent a viceroy over to rule their land. So now it's not just the Spanish conquistadors fighting amongst each other. They have done that, and both Almagro and Francisco Pizarro are dead. Now it's Pizarro's brothers who are fighting against the official Spanish hierarchy, which of course has the king on the top and his lieutenant, the viceroy. So they fight against him for some of Peru, and they lose. And consequently, Bustinza, who's on the losing side, is captured and executed while he's trying to raise native soldiers to aid surviving Pizarro brothers. And this is pretty insane. Now we have Beatriz, who is, I guess you could call her widowed once again, even though she wasn't really married to Mancho. She's 27 years old. She has three sons and, you know, the two princesses, and she's alone again. And around this time, around 1550, her sister also dies. You know, people really died very young at that time, so she was probably sick or something. So again, tough times has fallen on Beatriz, and she accepts marriage to a Spaniard named Hernandez, although he's but a tailor, she says. She's like, he's twice as old as he is. In the church, she says, when the priest says, you know, do you want to marry this guy? And she says, in her own language, in Quechua, maybe I will, maybe I won't. And the ceremony likely gets over with pretty quickly, so nobody is too embarrassed. But originally, Coya, or Beatriz, said no to marrying this guy. But another surviving half-brother of the family, Pau Yuinca, who was pretty quick to just, you know, ally with the Spaniards, and who is the official leader of the, shall we say, co-opted Inca nobles who live in Cusco, you know, those who are under the heel and boot of the Spaniards. He pressures her into doing this. He says, you know, we have these privileges here, even though we are controlled by the Spaniards. And do you really want to risk all that by saying no to this guy? The mayor and the governor, they want you to marry him as well. So she relents. But at first she says no, likely because she's pretty pissed now. She doesn't want to be controlled anymore or to have someone else dictate her life, but in the end she relents. Likely not just for her own sake or for the sake of her larger family, but also because what about her children? And somebody's got to provide for them. And all these really practical questions of survival and all that, which ultimately always decides the day. But then just a year afterward, Pau, he dies. And since there are no more surviving male members in this small Inca colony in Cusco, Beatriz, she becomes the de facto leader of the royal house in Cusco, the Inca royal house. So now we have two royal houses. We have one Inca royal house consisting of Beatriz and whatever surviving cousins and other family members who have flocked to Cusco to stay with her in her residence in the central part of the town, and who are, for all intents and purposes, controlled by the Spaniards. They want them to stay there, likely also as an example for the Inca rebels that, you know, if you stop fighting us, you can come here and you can live in peace and you can have a bit of land and everything will be good. Because there is still the other royal house, the independent rump Inca state of Vilcabamba, which is now led by Sayri Túpac, who is like the half-nephew, I guess, of Coyas. And they don't want to surrender. And their attacks on Spanish settlers increasingly become a problem. So in the mid-1550s, there is a new Spanish viceroy, Andrés Hurtado de Mendoza, and he decides things are going to have to change now. It'll be safer for everyone if we can get rid of this rump Inca state, and if Sayri Tupac could just be enticed to live in the area of Spanish settlement, like, you know, Coya / Beatrice's family, where the conquistadors can control him. So what do? You approach Beatrice, the leader of the Inca royal house in Cusco, and you talk to her about making contact with her long-lost nephew and enticing him to accept this deal. If he will just come to Cusco, he can get some land, he can live in peace, there will be no more war, everything will be fine. And, you know, Beatrice is now the highest-ranking royal Inca in Cusco, so she's the natural one to approach. These negotiations, they do take time, but eventually Sayri Tupac, he agrees to leave Vilcabamba. He renounces his claim to the Inca Empire. He accepts to get baptized. He gets a new name, as Coya did. Now he's called Diego. And in return for that, he receives a full pardon. He gets a title. He's called the Prince of Yucay. And he receives some great estates with some revenue. And he has to live there in Yucay, which is like a day's journey northeast of Cusco. Unfortunately, he doesn't get much time to enjoy it because he also dies quite suddenly, only a few years after he returns to Cusco. I can't help but think that he might have been subject to some of those new diseases which were there because of the Spaniards and maybe some of the slaves they had imported from the Caribbean and from Africa, and which he had never met before. But we don't know. He just dies. Sayri has a half-brother called Tito Cusi Yupanqui, who now takes control of Vilcabamba and says, "I don't want to surrender." The Inca resistance continues. And he also spreads rumors that Sayri Tupac has simply been poisoned by the Spanish. Likely it serves him well as kind of propaganda, so the remaining Incas can rally around him and say, "Oh, look at the Spaniards, they're so evil." Even though it makes absolutely no sense for the Spaniards to let him live there for some years and then give him poison. Coya's eldest son, Juan, he also played a part in these negotiations, but he only gets like a small reward, some land near Pisac, which is south of Cusco. And he lives a quiet life and dies as a relatively young man in about 1556, which also must have been really a blow for Coya. Then there is Pedro, her eldest legitimate son, and he, you know, takes over that estate, while Martin, her youngest son, takes over running her holdings at this place called Urcos. So that's how they do it. But still, it must have been pretty hard for Coya / Beatrice to see yet another part of her family just disappear. And she must also have felt a bit disappointed that this deal with Sayri Tupac didn't really lead to peace or anything. The Spanish viceroy, he is grateful for her help, even so, and he gives her some new land near Lake Titicaca, actually, so she can get back to the land where she grew up. But still, this must have been sort of a strange feeling for her, that she's in this position of power, and really the only true power she has she has power, she has some land, but all of the land is controlled by Spanish officials. Maybe her sons control it in name, but, you know, all the daily workings on the lands, the revenues from livestock and from agriculture produce, that's controlled by the Spanish, and she only gets a small part of that. So she has only a formal power. She doesn't have a true power there. And then when she actually gets asked to do something that, you know, links her to a true position of power, you know, she can actually get these negotiations going because of her family relationship with Sayri Tupac. She can convince him, and Juan can convince him to lay down his arms. Then it succeeds, but it doesn't really succeed because the Incas in Vilcabamba, they just fight on. It's only Sayri, a small host of Incas, who surrender. And from that point on in her life, things unfortunately go downhill very quickly. Her husband, Hernandez, the old guy there, he mortgages her property. She has quite a bit of property now, we must realize, but he mortgages it without her knowledge to pay for his loans at expenses. You know, he has got various entrepreneurial ventures in mining and so on and so forth, and he needs the money, and he comes to Koya with these documents that she can't read and tells her that it's about something else, and, you know, put your mark on there. You know, she can't write either, so she has sort of a personal mark she has to put there in lieu of a signature. And when he dies in the late 1560s, then there is a storm of litigation against Koya, because suddenly all these creditors pop up and they have debt. And Hernandez, he hasn't paid his debts. And so they want the land instead. And they want her house and they want everything that she has so stubbornly fought for to get so she can have some sort of life. And while this litigation is going on, an old shadow from the past returns. Mancho. He has now become mayor of Cusco. And he actually tries to help Koya by stating that the proceedings against her, they cannot go ahead until letters have been sent to the king for him to intervene. Because everyone has the right to ask the king to intervene and pardon them. And this could, of course, take a little bit of time because the king is over in Spain. But nevertheless, that holds the litigation for a short while. And then something happens, and we don't know why. But things start again, and Koya/Beatrice's property, goods, they are piecemeal auctioned away to her husband's creditors, and also to his illegitimate son, and she's left with next to nothing. So why couldn't Mancho stop that? Maybe he didn't want to. Maybe he felt that, you know, he had done what he could, and there were powerful people in Cusco whom he had to please, maybe some of her creditors, and, you know, he couldn't keep them away any longer. We don't really know why he was powerless to stop that. But it shows pretty much that if you are in Peru, then this, like, we'll wait for a letter from the king, because that's the official way to do things, doesn't count for that much. And thus it must have been a bittersweet experience for Beatrice when later that year in 1570, there actually arrives a letter from the king that pardons her and says that she has the right to her property, to her land. It's too late. The property is gone. The land is gone. And Beatrice, who's only age 50, she dies in the summer of 1571. She's simply too old and too tired to fight anymore. But she dictates her will in Quechua, her own language, for translation by her nephew. And in that will, she states that she owes nobody anything, which has some resonance after what happened to her. And in the years afterwards, her surviving sons, they fight to get some of her property, some of her goods back to their family, and are partially successful, presumably also using the letter of the king as a sort of a legal device to do that. But Koya, she doesn't live to see that. It's too late for her, sadly. And she's buried with her eldest son Juan in the monastery of Santo Domingo, which is not just any monastery in Cusco. It's actually the great Spanish monastery which was built on top of the old central temple of the sun in Cusco. So there's a nice symbolism there. But their graves are long gone, they'll be found. And whether or not Mancho, he was forthright in his intention to come back after 30 years and help her, that, you know, something we can speculate on for a long time. But he lives to a ripe old age and dies in 1589, where he, as the last conquistador, the last surviving conquistador, he dies then. And he writes a very famous confession before he dies, in which he says that he deeply regrets his participation in the destruction of the empire. But like so many things, that was too little and too late. So that was the life of Koya Kispiki-ki Manco Capac, also known as Beatrice. And we can see that it followed very much the trajectory of the Inca Empire, the fall of the Inca Empire, because the year after Koya has died, the last of the Inca holdout in Vilcabamba, it's wiped out and the leaders are executed. So I like to think of this story, which is obviously a very tragic story. I like to think of it as it's kind of a story that's really about the seasons of history. Like if history had a summer and a winter and a spring. And so there are seasons of our lives as well. And nothing lasts forever. So it's really a story about that. It's a story about how a life, which for a brief while Koya is very young, is very much like spring and summer. Everything is good. And then autumn sets in, and it's a very long autumn, and it becomes deep winter at the end for her. And it does so as well for the Incas, because the Inca Empire only thrived for about 100 years. It's about the 1430s when the first Inca expansion really began from the Cusco Valley. And then 100 years later, it's all gone. Great. Fast empire. You know, had a very brief summer, and then autumn and winter set in. You know, all things must change and end. So I hope you enjoyed this story, even if it was a hard story and a sad story. And rest assured, there'll be lots more about Coya and her life, about the fall of the Inca Empire, and about what happened to her family members after the fall of the empire. There'll be lots more about that in future podcasts and on the website. Check it out. Or sign up to our mailing list, and then you'll be notified when there is new material.